Hello and welcome back to the Future Worklife podcast. My name is Ollie Henderson and my guest today is Vanessa Pazos. Vanessa is a partner at Noba Capital, and after spending much of her career in HR and people roles, Vanessa is now focused on positively impacting the lives of millions of workers by investing in ambitious startups changing the future of work. I got to know Vanessa a few months ago and recently spoke at one of Noba's Connect events, and I've been really impressed with both Vanessa and Kevin, Noba's other partners, energy and passion for their work, and particularly how they support founders, whether or not they're part of their portfolio. So Vanessa and I talk about a range of subjects covering everything from the personalization of work to the role of technology, and importantly for Vanessa, how we can give women the best opportunity to thrive, whether as entrepreneurs or other members of the workforce. So if you're interested in hearing more about themes like this, you can get in touch with me to speak with your team or at your event. Please also connect with Vanessa and make sure you come along to one of Noba's future events. You'll find links in the show notes. So let's jump into my conversation with Vanessa Pazos. So Vanessa, very nice to have you on the show today. Thanks very much for joining me. We've got loads of potential areas we can talk about, but what's personally for you the area that you're most interested in?
For me, work needs to be personal or almost individual. And it's like ensuring that whatever the way someone works supports them and supports how they can thrive and be successful. So it's not having something dictated to say, this is the course you need to follow to be successful. It's okay, so this is what I want to do. What options do I have and how can I do that in a personalized way so I can thrive?
Yeah. Now, and that sort of makes sense, doesn't it? When you're a freelancer, say, or someone who has a portfolio career, basically where you're in control of the types of jobs that you take on, that personalized approach makes sense. We're seeing the manifestation of that more and more. How does that look for an organization who have got employees? Can you really personalize their work?
One of the things that a lot of people talk, culture is really important here. It's like creating the culture where people feel that they can openly communicate, they feel safe, they feel they can show up as themselves, they feel there's that learning culture if that's what they're trying to embed. And also ensuring there are options for people to upskill, there are tools available for people to be able to access and to take the opportunity to find areas where it might be better or not. And then having that kind of network, I think community network, that's super important within teams and out of teams. I think you mentioned it when we spoke last week, when you exited the business that you were at and then realised, oh, do I have a network? It's really important to encourage that. And we're seeing a lot of things currently, a lot of kind of innovative ideas where people are really focusing on how do we coach, mentor, support, build networks, build community. And I think ultimately it's not, I want to be a CEO, I should be speaking to another CEO to figure out what it is that I need or where are my gaps. It's more, how do we go down peer to peer and support each other, not just in the working environments, but I'm a single mum, you're a single mum, or I'm a carer. You're just find personal lifestyle things that match and allow you to support each other.
So there's two sides to that. So we've got technology can enable that kind of thing. And it's difficult, isn't it? Because I think for some people, they feel like technology gets in the way rather than actually enabling them to have a more personalized experience at work. Certainly for people who feel like they're always on or always available, technology can actually be a negative in some cases. What you described there is some kind of interactions which they might rely on technology to match you with other people who are in a similar life stage or have with similar ambitions or with similar challenges. But actually then the connection happens in the real world. I suppose I'm interested as a sort of broader point. Is that a trend that you see more commonly occurring or becoming more popular, where you're saying actually we can leverage technology to connect people, but then actually taking it offline is where you build real connection?
Yeah, I feel like, and also if I think of a personal context, the best connections I've made, either when I didn't expect them or when I've joined something and thought, oh, for example, I've recently started outdoor water swimming. And for me, going to do that was, I want to overcome my fear of the water. I want to go out and have a new challenge. But what I unexpectedly found was there was an amazing community of people that were supporting each other through, we're going to go and swim, but actually we're connecting on different levels, both professionally and personally. So it's, I do feel that there's so much more that you can get by being together in a room. And on my career, I think the best conversations we had as a team and what actually created that kind of that team build was when we weren't all in the room or all around a table and actually not even speaking about work. Those bonds are the ones that then allow you to feel safe, happy, and ultimately help you perform a lot better and support each other. And then obviously the tools come into place because that's how you work.
I do like it when people are rethinking what, say, hybrid means, because I think already hybrid's a relatively new term, but we're already in our minds probably associated with going into the office a certain number of days each week. Whereas a lot of companies are rethinking that even. They're thinking actually getting together regularly is important, but it doesn't have to be every week even.
But it doesn't even have to be in the office or have an office. It can be we're going to get together once a month and go all have a social, or we're going to get together once a month and do a team activity, or we're going to get together around a table and have a meal. It doesn't have to be going to work. So getting together doesn't necessarily have to be we're going to get together and just work.
And you worked in HR for years, and now the companies in the portfolio are obviously selling into large businesses. I'm thinking here, obviously in an early stage business, it doesn't cost very much to say all get a train into London or even go away for a weekend together in Europe and have a nice social. Once you start getting 500 people, 1,000 people, 10,000 people, 100,000 people, the logistics of it are just significantly more complex, and clearly it's far more expensive. So is that kind of idea about flexibility in work modes, and particularly the way you've described it, getting together more infrequently, is it unrealistic at scale? Is it just better for something which is a small or medium sized company?
I think it's unrealistic for the whole company to come together. It's just there's a lot more pain points to try and make that work. But I think how it translates is people will start coming together more as teams or smaller like communities, as to say.
Yeah.
And that's how I envision it would potentially work better in the larger organisations now.
So before you founded Noba yourself, you worked in HR roles for years. So it's an interesting career journey that, from HR into venture. What led you there? And I suppose, what do you bring in from those years of experience into a new type of role for you personally, but supporting businesses in probably a different way to many GPs in a venture firm would do so. So I'm really interested in just hearing your sort of personal journey and how you've ended up there.
Yeah, I think I've had such a varied career. I've worked in loads of industries, from oil and gas. I was at a football club at one point in my life, and also in startups. But I guess ultimately the thing that I've always been passionate about is working with people. And one of the biggest reasons why we built Noba was because for me, it had to mean something. It had to be around people. How could we make a difference? And how through our investment could we impact the lives of people? And so I guess what my career has taught me is always try lots of things, always like consistently, even if you don't know, don't be afraid to ask, don't be afraid to say, or just don't be afraid to take it away and go and figure it out. I guess I grew up in, my family were all immigrants. I grew up in a very community-led kind of family and environment. And it just showed me that by having people around you who could support you in the good and the bad, you were able to come to surface and thrive in things that were really important to you. So for me, building Noba was about how do I bring those elements, the people elements, bringing people together to the investment portfolio, and the little things that we've created, like we get leaders together, we have programs where we support potential talent that potentially has the opportunity to be really great and do really meaningful stuff. So it's how do we learn to work together in an environment where everything's always changing, we're always going to be facing similar challenges, but we can overcome these if we unite and we can make a much bigger impact. So I guess initially Noble wanted to make a huge impact on workers' lives. And for us, it was like, okay, us as NOBA, the only way we can really have a huge impact in doing this is if we continue to invest in businesses that have an impact on the lives of workers. Mm. And I guess one of my biggest values is fairness. I'm very big on fairness, and I want to like ensure that opportunities available to everybody. And I guess that's where the NOBA comes in, the no barriers. There's no barriers to invest in. There's no barriers to founders being able to come and like pitch to us and hopefully get to a point where they can get some funding. So it's almost like, how do we, through the ecosystem that we have, support more people, support more businesses? And if they're not in our portfolio, how can we support them by having those networks and those connections with other VCs, with other angels, and with other people in the industry that can then help them on their journey as well? So it's more, I guess it's the ecosystem that we're trying to build, and having people in the space that are like yourselves, that you're just fascinated about the space and you want to contribute in that way. Others will want to contribute because they want to invest. Others will want to contribute because they want to build something amazing. So it's almost, for me, that's the real reason that I'm behind this. Mm. Obviously, it's great to invest and back founders that want to do these things, but also we really enjoy the being hands-on and the supporting and helping that acceleration. And it's fun. It's fun because they're great ideas people working on, and not every day is the same. There's always a new challenge to be faced with.
You touched on there that, well, not just the language that you use when it comes to talking about relationships with founders and the community more generally, but also the way that you are hands-on. Thinking, for example, the way you used to personally talk about self-care and well-being and wellness. Now, yes, some of the portfolio businesses actually are companies that focus on well-being. They walk in a talk, but from your point of view, we've had several conversations, and every single time we both come back to talking about the importance of looking after yourself and the importance of making sure that founders can see that and giving a support network to help them realize it, because I know what it's like, and yeah, any founder knows what it's like when you're right in the weeds and you're going at it 100%. Sometimes it's difficult to take a step back and see when you're burning out and you need other people around you to be able to do that. Maybe it'd be interesting to hear why you're so passionate about that specifically. Yeah. Is it because of your own experience?
I guess the self-care I've only recently used those words. So maybe 2 years back, before I would have been practicing it and doing it, but probably called it something different. I think COVID taught us a lot. Before we thought self-care was eating well, working out, like things that were very obvious. Whereas I think we've now learned that self-care is whatever that is for you. So I think of my past and experiences. So when I was going through a divorce, self-care was running for me. I went out and I ran, and it helped me own myself and be myself. Where I went through a few years back, I had a health issue. Self-care there was meditating and going to the Buddhist center. So when I say self-care, I feel like it, well, for me personally, it is in that moment in time, self-care is what makes you feel good. And how do you go inwards? And I say this because I've recently done a lot of work on kind of internal family systems and looking inwards. If you can holistically be okay in and out, it [S2] Yeah. [S1] Will have such an impact on all other areas of your life. So it's almost, if I think, oh, I have this feeling, how am I feeling now? But if I'm sat here in front of a computer working and I've just received an email, but I'm feeling a certain way, I'm going to perceive that email differently to maybe if I was feeling differently. So it's almost, how do you support yourself to identify how you feel? Because mm-hmm. by identifying the feeling or identifying how you are, you can then put tools and things in place to help you react and respond to them. And I think that's really important, especially in a work environment, and especially for founders who are building startups where everything's quite stressful. You're always constrained on resources, on budgets. So it's almost like, how do you, and I think through the community we're building, we're very mindful that we encourage our founders to take time to move away and talk to other founders. And because otherwise burnout will happen and a lot of responsibility does go on you. And then there's also an element, not just of the burnout, is do you lose your own identity because you're just so focused on that peak and you're not really stopping to realize all those little wins that happen before you even get to that peak. And I think that's just how we are in general. We only focus on that end goal where there are so many wins along the way that we, unless we can stop, reflect and look, we won't see those. And they usually are more joyful moments than the actual peak because you're usually exhausted by the time you get to that peak.
Absolutely. Yeah, and when you get to that peak, you've often forgotten what your aspiration was at the beginning of the journey. That's the kind of,
I think one thing that I always say is success is what it means to you. So for some people, success might be, I've built this amazing business that is going to be one of the biggest unicorns and I've had a really good time. For others, it might be, I'm running a coffee shop that serves a community and that makes me happy. So for others, it's just simply, I got out of bed today. So it's like understanding that success is yours. And by having those kind of moments that looking inside and self-regulating yourself, you can really keep going and move forward.
In my book, there's the last part of it's called breakthroughs. And actually, it's really about rest, reflection, acknowledging your progress. But the reason I titled that bit breakthroughs is because actually that is the only way you have those breakthroughs. If you go at it 100% all of the time, you find yourself grinding it out and then grinding yourself into the ground. And it's actually usually when you take the moment to step back and just free your mind that you have the breakthroughs that help you make significant progress. In fact, I often talk about flow state. So I'm always looking at ways I can help improve my productivity and creativity. And so I'll try and tap into the principles of flow. But there is a one part of the flow cycle, it's called, which is called the release stage. So where in order to realize the benefits of flow, it isn't just about getting in the zone and working really hard. You actually have to step away. And that's when your unconscious mind takes over. And that's like a micro example of what happens on a bigger scale, whether you're a startup founder, whether you're a manager in a large organization, whether you're a freelance designer, it doesn't matter what you do. You have to be able to stop, step back, reflect, and like you say, recognize the progress you're making, because otherwise, before you know it, 10 years have passed and you can't quite acknowledge the successes that you have had along the way. And I say that because that was me a few years ago.
And it's interesting you say that, because I'm recently finishing, I don't know if you've heard, but the Body Holds Score, and it's very focused on trauma. And but actually, when you read some of the stuff, you can relate to how it can move out of the trauma kind of point. And one of the things that I read was like, in order for you to recover, your mind, your body and your brain all need to be convinced that it's safe to let go. So that's the thing. There's such a connection between the three. It's not just one element. It's being able to think, okay, I'm feeling, this is what I've, the name of the feeling, and this is how my mind's, and almost it's like a triangle. You have to put it all together. And I think people feel like, oh, I'll rest when it's done. No, the importance of stopping, coming away, resting along the way, I think is so important, because otherwise you won't be reaching that full potential, will you?
I know one area of focus for you in terms of your time that's really important is empowering women, particularly in the startup ecosystem.
Yeah, it's interesting, because actually there was this Economist report not a week or so ago where it actually was like, it was speaking about how motherhood kills women's careers. And it had some really shocking stats in the sense of like how globally 24% of mums after childbirth don't go back to the workforce. And then 5 years later, 17% are still not going back. And then if you look at it 10 years later, 15% remain out of the workforce. So I think a lot of it is having the support and kind of the tools to, not to get women back into the workforce, but to empower women to take on their identity again. So I think what happens a lot after I'm a mother and after you've had a child is you lose your identity a little bit. You become a mum, and it's helping have things in place that empowers you again. So I was meeting with someone yesterday who had taken a very successful businesswoman who had taken over 10 years out of her career, having worked at Maxwell's, having built her own businesses at NASCAR. So she'd done really important stuff and really meaningful stuff, but then she had that break to care for her elderly parents. And her diagnosis when she finished those 10 years was, I'd lost all my identity. I'd done all these amazing things and now I don't know who I am. And so for her, the way she found her kind of place and what her next steps were, she said she had a community around her of the children of neighbours that she'd been supporting and coaching. So she's now moved into coaching. But it's like some people don't have that light bulb moment or that opportunity to realise, actually, this is where I want to go into. So having tools and having groups and networks around you to support you to remember that who you are and remember that you can be whoever you want to be where and go down the path you want to take. You don't need to limit yourself to sit back and be scared to go into the workplace again. And so what I've found, I've got a women's breakfast series where I get groups of women together and the conversations are great because they're very chilled, very relaxed. They're women from lots of industries of lots of type. We get founders, we get successful women in their careers, women very early on. And actually the sharing and the learning, I think doing more of that and coming together more and then also having male allies to support that will definitely support, like I call it a movement, but where we want to take the shift.
Absolutely, yeah. It also takes us back to that point you mentioned at the beginning about personalization, because I'm probably guilty of this. Maybe you are to a greater or a lesser extent, I don't know. But whenever you think about solutions to the challenges in work, you often jump to technology being able to solve it all. And particularly at the moment when everyone's like, oh, how can we apply AI to improve efficiency and yeah. use an algorithm to improve this, that and the other? And in some ways, so I think about that example of somebody who's taken 10 years out of the workplace. I mean, I know loads of my friends and our family friends who have done the same thing. They've had young kids and they've either completely changed career or they've just taken time off. And it is really hard to go back into work after that. And in a sense, the risk of, say, I'm thinking about, let's say, an applicant tracking system, which is a piece of technology which ultimately allows you to see who's applying for roles and then track them through the system. And the problem is with these systems, they're often designed with templates in mind, where they're saying, you have to fit certain parameters and it'll even have red flags against things like career gaps. And I wonder if we're at risk of designing systems which make this problem worse, and how we can go about fixing it. I'm not, by the way, I'm not suggesting in the next sort of 10-15 minutes we can answer this huge problem, but I think there is a risk, isn't there, that technology can actually make some of these systemic problems worse.
It's funny you say that because I've just finished a piece of coursework on this and it actually talks about how technology can advance us so much, but if we don't make sure that the people kind of training the AI, mm-hmm. they'll take their bias and that will formulate theirs. So there has to be policies, process, even laws. Some countries have embedded laws into, I know the US have done it, the state, like New York, the reporting back is really important. So I guess when we think of recruitment, reporting why you didn't hire people and being committed to showing what parameters you followed, because otherwise, like you say, the technology is being created by humans and that unconscious bias they might have might be put into the technology they're building. So I think there has to be an element of both. There has to be an element of the human bit that manages the platform. And if something, a red flag comes up, you're like, okay, I'm not sure. And being able to communicate that and ensure that it's regularly monitored and reviewed, that it's still fit for purpose and things are working, how to commit to what you're trying to achieve. And yeah, it's also training the people to use the platforms and technology, because I think a lot of the time we're not born as natural interviewers. So it's ensuring that you know what you're looking for, or you know how to get the best out of the platform and the questions you're asking. One of our businesses in the portfolio does that. It does interviewing and it's a platform that supports that. And I think it's back to your point about managers, and anyone has the potential to be a great manager if they're trained and they're purposeful and they know we will all fall back into bad habits. And if we don't have those processes in place to keep checking in and making sure that it's still fit for purpose, we will fall into that kind of path of maybe it's not fit for purpose.
A continuation of that thought is how we identify talent and bring that talent into a team. So I think about how I used to do it. I'm way more interested in people who have got some sort of different story to tell about their career. Yeah, like having showing competency and skills is clearly important. Like they're there, like table stakes. Like you understand what's required of you and have the basic skills to do the job. But then beyond that, I'm really interested in what makes people different. And the fact that you've got a completely different life experience for me is a positive. I suppose the challenge often is, how do you do that at scale? And particularly when maybe as a manager or a leader, you're not as confident about picking people who are different, because sometimes it's safer to just choose someone who looks the same. There's many ways to find looking the same. But ultimately, that's where you end up with these homogenous organizations of people who don't actually show very much differentiation, and therefore it inhibits innovation and growth. So again, not sure how we solve that problem in a short conversation, but you must see that as well.
I think it's also ensuring that the selection team is diverse in itself, and diversity comes in so many shapes and forms. I think what we found, and this isn't in just the recruiting part, what we found when we were looking for our pipeline businesses that were coming in is there must be, in that investment committee team, there has to be a diverse set of skills, a diverse set of genders, right? You have to not be able to say, okay, that whole team's going to identify with this, because guess what? Unconsciously, you're going to connect on a different level. And so I guess sometimes for the recruitment element, the platforms are good because they eliminate those things. So if I'm interviewing you, Ollie, you tell me that you support Arsenal and I support Arsenal, it's like, oh, okay, we're connected now. I like Ollie. So the platforms allow for that to be eliminated and not be a tick point. So it does help in that aspect. But for larger organisations, it's hard because I guess they need to fill a lot more roles. And by using technology solution, it allows them to reduce costs, place quicker. So they have to make sure that actually that they set a set of criteria that they have to follow, and unfortunately they'll have to just see how they fit into those. I think the joys of startups is, I don't know if it's a joy actually, is you never have enough people. You're always very lean, but actually you usually have a few people that wear multiple hats, and like you say, the play of the behavior, the character, how they are comes in a balanced way of, can they also do the job?
Yeah.
And it's hard because there's a lot more factors to take into account when you talk about larger corporates. It's not so simple to say, I can do A, B and C and that's it.
So we talked about various challenges, but we think about solutions. For those companies that you're seeing, we see certain trends in what companies are developing and problems they're addressing. But are there any sort of overlooked areas or areas that people listening might not have be thinking about, might not hear about as regularly, whether in the work of your portfolio businesses or the sort of companies that pitch into you?
I just think because nearly everybody's a worker, you can tap into so many different industries, and we've had solutions put forward that we were like, oh, okay, yeah, like, they are workers. We get it, like the farming industry, the maritime. But it's, I think we haven't, and I would love to see the more fintech play of how do you support like freelancers financially, or how's that coming into play? So if I'm a freelancer, I can't prove what my annual income is because I don't know what that's going to be. How am I still able to access kind of a loan if I need it, or a mortgage if I need it? So it's that sort of play that we haven't really seen huge amount. We've seen a lot around how do we support people through their finances to organize it, get the best deals when it comes to insurances or different elements of things they'll need throughout the, but we haven't really seen a financial flexibility of I want to buy a house, and how do I do that if I don't have a full-term contract that says this is how much I earn every year? And I guess the same can apply to founders. They're not earning what they could be earning if they're doing a kind of a corporate job. So it's those sort of solutions that allow flexibility for workers to go ahead and have plans. And then we see a lot of similar, I think, how upskilling might move throughout the years. So it's almost like, how do you train people in a hybrid or remote world? It's changing. So some really strong solutions in that space would be really, really great to see. But I guess it's constantly going to be changing, and the new generations coming in are usually showing us the new waves that might dictate what might come in.
Well, on that point, we often hear about the differences between different generations. Is that true from, again, I'm thinking particularly of some of the businesses that you are working with. Are they tapping into trends which are based on specific differences to, say, Gen Z coming into the workplace? Or are actually there fewer differences than we might think, and we're still solving problems which existed from previous generations?
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that we like to think there are differences, but I think the only differences are priorities or like agenda items. So what I'm seeing is there's a lot more focus on kind of sustainability, impact. People will join, will be part of a business if it's meeting some of those agenda items that they value as important. But I guess that will change depending on who you're talking to. So someone might be like, no, for me, it's more about having really important like experiences, doing a job that makes a difference for something else. So there's obviously a change, but there's a change more in priorities of what grabs them and what makes them excited, I think.
Look, we are nearing the end of our time, and I really appreciate you sharing your thoughts and your story with us today. I will include various links to you and Tenobra in the show notes, because I know you'd welcome anyone else getting in touch and joining the community. Anything else you want to leave us with specifically before we wrap up?
No, I think it's just thank you. It's really great to like just constantly be talking to people who have a point of view, and I guess we have a point of view of where we feel like the future of work and tech and the future of work is changing, but we're always open to having other people reaching out and challenging that and saying actually, and I think collectively, like I've said before, that is how we will make a difference, if together we all have different ideas and different thoughts and can move in that direction.
Brilliant. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thanks.
So thanks again to Vanessa, and thanks to you for listening. Next week, I'm speaking to David Green about people analytics and how data and technology can help shape an exciting future of work. So I'll see you here again then.